Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Fidelity's Director of Global Macro, Jurjen Timmer, joins us again for his market outlook and global macro update. Jurjen looks at jobless numbers with host Pamela Ritchie, noting that jobless claims moved to the 6 millions at the start of the pandemic. It's back down to around 700,000 now, but it's still not at pre-COVID levels. Jobless numbers and stimulus are connected, and Jurjen believes that the Fed is correct in its messaging about keeping interest rates low. The gap between the unemployment rate and full employment is still high at 6.3%, but the gap was close to 20% a year ago. Jurjen also comments on emerging markets, inflation, and the rotation towards value, noting that a barbell strategy between value and growth is common. Per usual, Jurjen will be sharing some charts, so pull up at Timmer Fidelity on Twitter to follow along. I'll direct you to the specific tweet and chart. Also, this podcast was recorded on April 5th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
We're happy to be joined by Fidelity's Head of Global Macro, Jurjen Timmer. Great to see you, Jurjen.
Hi, Pamela. Nice to be with you again.
So let's go a little bit back in time. It was a holiday for many on Friday. The jobs report came through. Obviously, it was kind of expected to be stellar, and it was. What does all of that mean for those watching markets today, where we're seeing things do?
Yeah, I mean, it shows that the markets are very efficient in discounting all known information that's out there, and the markets were early and right in basically pricing in this exact scenario, right? It started last fall with the rotation to value in small caps, with bond yields starting to rise, and it's continuing really at breakneck speed. You look at the markets today, it's a really, really strong, broadly based rally. You know, S&P up above 4,000. I think something like 90% of stocks are above their 50-day moving average, and it's just nice to see that the rotation out of large growth did not take the market down with it, which is a conversation that we and many other people were having a few months ago, because the FANGs, you know, those five stocks are 25% or were 25% of the market. And so a lot of people thought that once that leadership rotated towards value and small, the whole market would take a hit, and that has not happened. So it's a sign of a bull. And, you know, just maybe we can take a look at a couple of slides here.
This first chart from Jurjen was tweeted April 6th in the morning, titled ISM.
Just to put some visuals around just how strong things are, I mean, it's really an incredible thing. So this chart is a different take on the ISM, or the PMI, as we call it, the Purchasing Managers Index. You know, we have those for basically all the countries around the world and for regions, but this one is the U.S., The dots, so the horizontal axis shows the deviation from the mean in terms of the index itself. So this is a diffusion index of manufacturing, of purchasing managers, if you will. And it's a survey where they ask, you know, are things getting better or worse? So to the right means better, to the left means worse. And so I've created a scatter plot against, on the vertical axis, the prices paid component. And so back in the financial crisis, bottom left corner, that's the worst case scenario, right? You get a kind of a depression and deflation, and then on the upper right hand side you have an inflationary boom. And guess what? That's where we are, and it's just really almost off the charts in terms of how strong at least the goods producing side of the economy is.
It's amazing because we've been talking a lot about supply chains and what, you know, what isn't there. But as you say, there's this catch up, there's the reflation, there's some power behind it.
Yeah, and you know, and of course, everyone is wondering, what does this mean for the Fed? Will the Fed take the punch bowl away? You can see it in terms of the pricing of future rate hikes. You can see it in the dollar, which we'll talk about a little bit later. My sense is that the Fed is correct in its very persistent messaging that it's going to keep its foot on the gas pedal for a while longer. And the reason for that is that despite the blockbuster employment number on Friday, if you look at the unemployment rates, the various ones.
To follow along here, pull up the fiscal and monetary policy chart, also tweeted the morning of April 6th.
You look at the gap between the unemployment rate and what is considered full employment, or the natural rate of employment. The U6, which is the broader measure, is still 6.3 percentage points above full employment. And that puts it, and so that's kind of the burgundy line at the top. So the green line way at the bottom in that upper panel is college grads, and then you've got everything in between. So the U6 is the broadest measure and includes people who, you know, are working part-time but want to work full-time, or they're discouraged or this or that. And so 6.3% is way down from where it was, which was close to 20% a year ago. So it's obviously tremendous progress, but it's still a large gap. And so I think the Fed, as well as the Treasury on the fiscal side, they're going to keep this thing going until that gap is basically fully closed.
So let me ask you, in the jobs report last week, when you looked at it and then you think about the U6 and obviously the sort of this question of, is it a single mandate Fed? What in the jobs report, you know, basically went towards filling the gap for U6 and you know, what didn't? Where did you see the nuance?
Yeah, it's been a steady state improvement. And actually, maybe we can pull up the next slide.
And this one is crisis and recovery, also from the morning of April 6th.
It shows a slightly different take. That shows jobless claims at the top of the top panel, and you know, earnings revisions in the bottom, as well as the Fed's weekly economic index, which again is a diffusion index. But you know, it's interesting. You can see kind of the heart attack right in the top panel. Everything was at a steady state. 250,000 jobless claims per week in the U.S., then up to 6 million plus, and now back to 719. And you know, the scaling kind of makes this chart look like not a lot of progress is being made, but there is. But it's coming off of such an extreme. Same with the unemployment data in the previous slide. That, you know, there are still a gap of about 300,000-400,000 people per week filing claims that weren't filing them, you know, before the pandemic. So by no means is this an all clear signal, but clearly the goods producing side of the economy, especially with supply chains disrupted. You know, we all know about the Suez Canal thing. Apparently the ships are lining up outside the port of LA. There are huge bottlenecks and there's no inventories, lots of pricing power, and this is where the inflation narrative is coming from. And so the good side of the economy is on fire, but the server side obviously is still coming back. It is coming back, but there's still a lot of restaurants that are not fully open or stores that are open only to certain capacity. So there's more that needs to be done, and I think that's what the Fed and the Treasury are basically saying. And don't worry about inflation later when it comes and they see the whites in the eyes. But at this point, I think inflation would have to go north of 2 and stay there for a while. And the Fed, like many other market watchers, I think are assuming that inflation is going to come. You see it in the ISM chart. I mean, it's here, but that it's going to be transitory. And so the Fed that narrative would have to be proven wrong, i.e. the transitory would need to become structural for the Fed to actually take the punch bowl away here.
So you have a chart talking a little bit about, you know, yields on the rise. Everyone's watching them, obviously. And there is sort of this question about at what height do stocks then fall? And how long does it have to be sustained for? Can you bring that into the discussion? The yield story, obviously.
Yeah, kind of a fun, you know, fun with charts. I mean, I should be calling my weekly thing fun with charts from now on.
Yes, because you should.
I do have a lot of fun with charts. But this is the 30-year Treasury yield going back to 1978.
Okay, this slide here is titled U.S. Long Bond and was tweeted April 8th in the morning.
This is the 30-year Treasury yield going back to 1978, and all I've done is run an exponential regression line through that, and you can kind of see that, you know, obviously bond yields, they trend, And within that very long trend, which for the last 30 years has been down, they move, right? They zig and zag around that trend. And so obviously, a year ago, the 10-year yield briefly went down to 0.3%. The 30-year went to 0.7%. It's now back to 2.5 or so percent. Based on this chart, without knowing anything more, I would guess that the 30-year could go to 3%, and that means the 10-year could go to maybe a little bit north of 2, but that's just a guess based on this chart. But it does bring up the obvious questions of, you know, how long can yields just keep rising? And, you know, they're up 125 basis points in the last year. And how long can that can that continue with the stock market completely living in a state of blissful ignorance? It brings to mind the 87 parallel, right? So we all remember, well, maybe we don't, but I remember 87. Those were the Greenspan Fed days. And in early 87, the Fed was tightening policy. Bond yields were soaring. They ended up going to 10%. And the stock market for the first, you know, 10 months of that year, or for the 6 months or so from April to October, completely ignored it. And then, of course, the stock market crashed. And at the time, a very popular indicator was called the Fed model, which actually the Greenspan Fed, I think, either created or certainly used. And that just showed the simple ratio of the PE of the stock market to the PE of the 10-year bond. And the PE for the bond is just the inverse of the yield, right? So it's what you're willing to pay for your stream of coupons. And so back then, that Fed model went to 111%. So in other words, the bond yield or the stock market was twice as expensive as the bond market, or the bond market was twice as expensive as the stock market, let's put it that way. It's hard to compare that to now, because when yields started falling to like 2% and 1%, the PE of the bond market went to 100, 200X, and it no longer became a meaningful comparison, because the stock market's been trading at around 20 times earnings for a while now. But if you line them up on different curves and you kind of look at the ups and the downs, and you kind of curve fit them, with the caveat that curve fitting is a chart crime, but still sometimes we got to do it, you can see that the line is not anywhere close to where it went in 87. So my sense is that because yields are rising from a very low level, and have not really risen that much, 125 basis points is not the end of the world, and a lot of it has been inflation expectations. For all of those reasons, I think the stock market is not yet in the danger zone of where rising yields could take it.
Do we still find ourselves with a lot of volatility, though? I mean, to what extent do you sort of watch almost a combination of consolidation for some of the big trades that have happened in the last 6 months, along with, you know, maybe increased volatility? I mean, I wonder if you can sort of put both of those into the story.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this at the beginning of the year, that my expectation was that 2021 would be a year where most of the action would take place underneath the surface and not at the surface. And I think that's been generally the case, right? And again, those FANG stocks falling out of favor and then being 25% of the market, and then rotating into a much smaller segment of the market. Small caps, by definition, are smaller. A lot of people would have thought, and I certainly was open to that possibility, that if that rotation were to happen, it would take the whole market with it, right? And we just think about 2000, right? The dot-com bubble was essentially that. These mega cap growers fell off their podium. And they took the whole market with it. Market went down 53%. That is not happening. So the volatility is there. And we saw this, you know, the hedge fund that blew up, or the family office that blew up last week, the GameStop short squeeze a few months ago. Those were kind of big tremors in the market, you know, and they caused volatility. But they were like one-offs, right? And even the thing last week with the Archegos, immediately the thing that rushes to my mind is like, oh my God, how many more of these are there out there? Is this a systemic thing? And maybe it is, I don't know. You know, one of the problems with this leverage is that it's invisible. You can't see it. There's no data series that can show us what they are, because they're off the books. And I'm sure this particular family office and its prime brokers will be called, I'm sure, to testify in front of Congress at some point. But so far, they have been isolated incidents, and the rotation is volatile, but then it passes and the market kind of goes back to doing what it's doing, which is to price in a booming economy.
So it's absolutely fascinating. There's a few questions rolling in here. So people wanting to sort of go back to your thoughts on gold, and I wonder if we sort of pair that with a discussion of USD and go into that discussion a little bit. Gold has come up off the bottom a little bit. We've seen sort of a bit more of an appetite. I don't know how much of that fits with the cryptocurrency story, but give us your thoughts on sort of currencies, including gold.
Yeah.
If you want to call that.
So gold's at 1732. About $50 off the lows. Gold continues to trade in lockstep with the 10-year real yield. So the real yield on the 10-year tips, all you need to do is pull up that chart, put the scale upside down, and you have the price of gold. I think gold is suffering, you know, gold is being cannibalized by Bitcoin. There's no question in my mind, because anyone who is now looking at hedging against monetary inflation, which gold ultimately is and has been, and Bitcoin is as well. If they're starting like right now for the first time, they're going to like, okay, gold, Bitcoin, which one do I take? You know, Bitcoin is a more convex version of gold. So I am bullish on gold. I've shown a chart in the past. I don't think I have it here. I don't. But that shows that during past periods of monetary inflation, by which I define as prolonged periods of above average growth in the money supply, and so the 30s and 40s were one of those, the 60s and 70s were one of those periods, and then post the financial crisis as well. During those regimes, the value of above ground gold, so all the gold that has been mined, the market value of that gold tends to rise relative to the economy and to the money supply, because it's a hedge. And so at some extremes, it's been like 80, 90% of M2. Today, it's only like 50%. So if this monetary inflation era continues, then gold should be going up. And it's interesting, you know, Bitcoin, of course, is stealing the show right now. At some point, I think this will become a pairs trade, like a relative value trade, in the same way that gold versus silver is one, or gold bullion versus the gold mining stocks is one. These all become relationships that will be traded. It's a little early for Bitcoin to kind of join that, because it's only 10 years old and the rise has been parabolic. But I think at some point in the future, when people want to hedge against monetary inflation, they'll say, yeah, normally I would buy gold. Bitcoin is more fun, but Bitcoin is now so many times the value of gold. So maybe I'll do some gold, some Bitcoin, some miners, some this. And I think they will all be kind of seen as the same asset class. And of course, they will be the opposite of the dollar. And you asked about the dollar. You know, the dollar has been a head scratcher this year, because certainly it was the consensus trade at the beginning of the year that the dollar would go down, which would make perfect sense, right? You look at the debasement that's happening in this chart.
And this chart here is titled the U.S. dollar and was tweeted April 7th in the afternoon. And next up will be credit spreads and the U.S. dollar, which is the tweet after the U.S. dollar chart.
This chart, this is a quarterly chart or a monthly chart of the U.S. dollar index overlaid against the twin deficits, budget and trade. And you can see that, you know, the amount of money that is being spent and monetized, that the dollar should be going down. But it was the overwhelming consensus. And the consensus, of course, even if they're right long term, they can be wrong over the near term. And if we go to the next slide, you can see the disconnect in the last few months, where the dollar has been going slightly up and credit spreads continue to go down. And that's a divergence, if you will, that, you know, as a reflation early cycle bull like myself, I don't want to see that. That is potentially a red flag, because the dollar really should be joining the narrative of rising yields and deficit spending and money printing and all that stuff. So one of the reasons gold, I think, is under pressure is because the dollar is up. The other one is because real rates are no longer falling. They're still negative, but they're no longer falling, because it's now real yields that have been ticking up. But my sense is that over the long term, the dollar story will continue to play out. And, you know, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, why are real yields picking up. There could be a few reasons for that, but something that affects the dollar. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think real yields, and I don't have a slide this week, but real yields, I think, are really one of the key reflation indicators. And I think what's happening is that the market is betting that the Fed will exit its accommodations stance sooner than the Fed says or thinks it is, right? So I think that's really what this is about. So the bond vigilantes are starting to price in a Fed normalizing policy in late 2022, while the Fed is saying it's going to be way longer than that. And before they even raise rates, they need to taper asset purchases. So they're a long ways away from that. But the Fed, the market doesn't believe the Fed. And I think, you know, that's causing real yields to rise. So nominal yields have been rising. They're 170, 175. The first move up in that rise in yields was all inflation expectations. But the last month or two, it's been more real yields. And that will drive the dollar. It's interesting. It's also driving currency hedged yield opportunities for foreign investors.
So here, please take a look at Urien's chart, Global Yields, tweeted April 8th in the morning.
And this could be moving the dollar higher as well. It's anecdotal. I don't have any evidence for this, but you know, back in 2019, when the Fed had normalized policy, so the Fed funds rate was north of 2%, while the rest of the world was still at negative, at that point, the arbitrage for, let's say, a German insurance company or a Japanese pension fund to buy U.S. treasuries and hedge them back into euros or yen, that arbitrage was completely wiped out because the spread between monetary policy between the different central banks was so big. Now that spread is gone. You know, everyone is at or near zero. And now a German institution can buy U.S. treasuries hedged back into euros at almost 2%, whereas the 10-year Bund is trading at negative 0.3. So maybe this is actually driving capital flows into the U.S. But again, it's a hard thing to prove. It's all kind of anecdotal. But maybe it's just a capital flows thing that's supporting the dollar in the belief that the Fed is going to take the punch bowl away sooner rather than later. Again, I'm not buying that narrative, but that doesn't matter what I believe. If the market believes it, then it's going to happen.
And that's the observation. And it's interesting. It wasn't so long ago that, in fact, the thought was on a relative basis, actually euro-denominated everything, assets, would in fact take that role. But
and that's another thing, right? Europe is woefully behind in vaccinations. France is back into a nationwide lockdown. My son in Dublin, they're still in lockdown. And so I think there's also a gap going on between the U.S., which is vaccinating people like there's no tomorrow. I think they're vaccinating 3-4 million people a day now. I'm eligible starting today, so I'm hoping to get an email soon. But, I mean, it is a very, very impressive story. And the U.S. is just, you know, crushing it relative to Europe. So I think there's also that angle to it, where the European recovery is just a lot slower.
Absolutely. It's just that the reflation trade that you discuss comes, I don't know if it's 6 months later or whatever it is, but months later, perhaps, than the United States. Anything that we need to talk about sort of on, we've got a few minutes left here, but to go to sort of the discussion of continuing what we're seeing in markets today, a rotation towards value, away from growth. I mean, that said, certainly people have been dipping their toes back in the water for tech. We saw NASDAQ actually leading the way, I think, earlier this morning. I don't know if it's still is, but it's there. I mean, is there a barbell strategy that's needed, or how do you look at that?
There totally is.
This slide here is Sector Correlations, tweeted April 7th in the morning.
Rolling correlations between the various S&P sectors and styles against the bond yield. And you can see very clearly it's a tale of two markets, right? So the lines that are low and falling, that's your tech, your consumer staples, your large cap growth. So these are higher PE growth stocks that are very sensitive to changes in the discount rate. And by discount rate, I mean the interest rate at which cash flows are discounted in the discounted cash flow model. So you can see that large growth is minus 49% correlated changes in the five-year yield. And at the top panel, you see financials, energy, small value, industrials, materials. They're all 40, 50, 60% positively correlated. And so this is the rotation at work. As yields rise, not only are the correlations have different signs depending on whether you're value or growth, but those signs are getting bigger, right? So the positive correlations are getting more positive as more people rotate into them, and the negative correlations get even more negative. So it's definitely, this is that churn that's happening under the surface. And again, in the past few months, the question was never between, you know, when we talked whether this would happen, because this was our playbook. The only question was, would this happen in a rising or a falling market? And, you know, it's happening in a rising market, which is great news.
And this slide is stocks bonds correlation, also tweeted April 7th in the morning.
You know, the big conversation I think that we all need to have beyond this cycle, beyond this reopening trade, is whether inflation pressures, which we know are accelerating as we speak, whether those expectations will become entrenched or whether they will be transitory. And there's very good arguments to be made on both sides. You know, I've been skeptical of structural inflation because of the demographic story, which we've discussed. You can see so I show here the 10-year rate of change in inflation in the horizontal. So the vertical line is the average, which is about 2.7%. So this is a 10-year CAGR of the CPI. And then the vertical is the 5-year correlation of stocks to bonds, so S&P 5 versus long-term government bonds. And you can see the three different major regimes, right? So way on the left, Great Depression, deflation, 1930s. You know, that's an episode that hopefully we will never revisit. Then in the middle, down to the bottom of the slide, is the Goldilocks, so disinflation, 1% to 3% inflation. And then in the upper right is the rising to high inflation regime of the late 60s and 70s. And we know, of course, that for the past two decades, we've been in that Goldilocks bucket there. And you can see how consistently negative the correlations are, minus 50, minus 40, minus 30% between stocks and bonds. But as you kind of migrate towards a higher inflation regime, those correlations become very, very positive. And in fact, you notice how that bottom right quadrant of the chart is basically completely empty. And that tells you that when inflation goes from below average, which is just south of 3%, to above average, again, this is using a 10-year rate of change, not a 1-year rate of change. But when that happens, the correlation is basically has never been negative. So again, this is a big thing to get right. And again, maybe it's all theoretical because maybe inflation will just be transitory as the Fed believes, and we won't be having this conversation a year from now. But if inflation expectations somehow become entrenched and we go into 3, 4, 5% inflation over a longer period of time, the 60-40 is not going to work anymore. You know, we need to then recalibrate the 40 and go from duration to tips or credit, you know, gold, Bitcoin, you know, those kinds of asset classes that store value. And even on the 60, we wouldn't want to underweight the 60, but we want to change what that 60 looks like, because in that regime, you are going to have persistent outperformance by value, small caps, non-US, et cetera. So again, it's theoretical right now because we don't know whether this is going to be an issue or not, but it's just, I think, a fun chart to kind of illustrate that it really is a binary thing between negative and positive correlations.
And it's fascinating because you actually just answered all of the follow-up questions there, which have to do with 60-40, which have to do with then what with the 40. And also you've pointed to international, and there's a question coming in about EM. We've got about a minute if you just want to very quickly address EM, but yeah.
Well, still bullish on EM, but EM is kind of falling victim right now to the reset in real rates, the rising dollar, financial conditions are becoming less accommodative because real yields have risen about 50 basis points. Not a huge deal, right? Back in the taper tantrum in 2013, real yields rose 150 basis points in 6 weeks. That was a bona fide shock. We're not there yet. You see in the 87 analog, we're not there yet. But I think it just things have gotten less good because of that mix of real yields, the dollar, financial conditions. And so therefore, EM is kind of sitting on the back burner for now. But it's still, it's still structurally, you know, very bullish trade as far as I'm concerned.
Fascinating. Thank you for pulling it all together for us. And we'll see you again next week.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you, Jurian. Jurian Timmer joining us today. Have a good day. I'm Pamela Ritchie.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.